So delirium is a condition that occurs when people are medically unwell. And in palliative care, people have advanced illness, but they often have lots of other intercurrent medical problems or other medical illnesses that are occurring concurrently. And any of those new events or complications of existing illness, often many of those together precipitate the condition called delirium, which is really your brain reacting to the chemicals, the inflammation or the medications that are in your system.
And what sort of symptoms are we talking about for delirium?
The key symptom is a problem called inattention. So normally when we're interacting with people, we focus. So a person with delirium will be inattentive. They often are drowsy or hyper alert, so a change in their conscious level. And then there's a lot of other associated symptoms such as sleep-wake problems, perceptual disturbance, so hallucinations, seeing things that are not there, hearing things that are not there, mistaking objects as something else. So they might think the nurse who's bringing the tablets is bringing them poison. The bed sheets might look like spiders, those sorts of things.
Are health professionals aware of these symptoms?
When the person is overtly agitated, distressed, trying to get out of bed or responding to the things that are happening to them, it's often very obvious to everybody. The problem is, especially in people with advanced illness, a lot of the signs of delirium are very subtle. The person is just not attending to their environment. And often people assume it's just they're having a bad day or just feeling a bit unwell when actually they've got a medical emergency happening.
You mentioned that it's caused by all the chemicals that are in a person's body. I'm guessing that's from something like cancer treatment.
So we know that delirium has an inflammatory component, but imbalance in neurotransmitter levels. So there are several neurotransmitters that are thought to be involved. So the dopamine pathways, the acetylcholine pathways, and also the pathways that are involved in sleep-wake cycles, so melatonin, tryptophan, serotonin. And we know very little actually about the pathophysiology of delirium, and even in the last few years there's been a lot of new research implicating new neurotransmitters.
What happens when we identify symptoms, or when health professionals identify symptoms of delirium? What sort of treatment is offered?
So I think the first thing is that a clinician has to actually diagnose it as a condition. So there's a constellation of symptoms and signs, and with any syndrome, someone has to put that all together and call it delirium. And once that's happened, then people start looking for what the medical precipitant might be, and that might be an infection, it might be a recent change in medication, might be an altered level of, say, calcium in the blood, or new spread of the cancer to the brain, for example. And usually there's more than one cause that's happening at any one time. And then the clinician has to think through what the possible treatments of those precipitants are. And in a fair number of people, they're reversible problems that can be fixed with reasonably simple medical treatments such as intravenous fluids, antibiotics, or readjusting the medications to a better regimen. But while you're doing all of those things, you have a highly distressed, confused person. Really, the critical things then is around the nursing care and the support of that person, but also their family, so that you manage that distress and symptoms whilst the actual medical condition has time to resolve, which can take a few days.
So your research has looked at whether a placebo is the best for that compared to antipsychotic medication. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
So what we do know is that good nursing care, orientating people to the environment, maintaining their hydration, making sure they don't have any sensory deficits, so their vision and hearing is maintained, that their mobility is as maximal as possible, and that they have familiar people with them. We know that that improves delirium symptoms over time. And we also know if you treat the underlying precipitant, that delirium will improve over time. So what we set out to do is offer all of those treatments to people, but one of the other treatments to manage delirium symptoms, especially if they're severe, is to use antipsychotic medications. So we had some people given haloperidol, some people given risperidone and some given a placebo treatment to really test whether adding an antipsychotic to those other measures, which is part of the routine management of delirium, did it offer any additional benefit in improving the symptoms faster or better.
When you're talking about this chemical imbalance that causes delirium, do you think that antipsychotic medication is exacerbating that chemical imbalance? Would that be reasons why that those symptoms didn't disappear?
In terms of the biological mechanism, I think our trial can't answer that question, but I suppose we hypothesise either that those medications aren't targeting the right area in the brain, or the actual mechanism by which they act adds to the neurotransmitter balance and actually potentially makes the symptoms worse.
And were you surprised by these results?
I think we went into the trial not knowing what we were going to find. It's interesting that there are several groups of clinicians who have very strong views about how delirium should be treated. There's a group of clinicians who very rarely use medications and would say that there isn't a role for medications in the treatment of delirium. There's another group who only use it in very specific situations where the safety of the patient or the distress is so high that they feel that something from a medication point of view needs to be done. And there's another group of clinicians who think that they have a widespread role. So we really went into the trial knowing that there was quite a difference in clinical opinion and that we needed a trial to help unpack which of those approaches was actually better from an evidence point of view. I suppose me personally, as I've thought about delirium, cared for patients under my care with delirium, the more attention I've paid to the elements of nursing care, I think I've become more convinced that there's a lot of merit in those strategies.
Is there anything else that you can suggest in the area of nursing that would further improve care?
Looking at our ward environments, there was a really nice study where a group of delirium researchers went and lay down on every single bed in a ward and actually looked at whether they could see the clock. So if you're in a hospital environment, the lighting is artificial and you don't know what time of the day it is, your orientation to your environment is already impaired. And so if you're already unwell, you add some disorientation because your environment is not suited to you. If you don't have visitors, you won't actually know that it's the evening visiting time, actually. So our environments with very simple signage or calendars or clocks and making sure people can see them and it's in font that they can actually read can make big differences. And the number of people who need glasses, who their glasses are at home, need hearing aids and their hearing aids are at home. If you can't hear or see what's happening in your environment, again, it's very disorienting. So they're maintaining as much normal function, normal cognition as possible. So if they do get an infection, their brain and their physical function is offering them the best resilience, I suppose, to not be impacted by that problem as much as if those things weren't attended to.
I think the important thing you also mentioned was that delirium is curable. How long does it take to cure delirium?
So I suppose I would go one step before that and say delirium is preventable in a large proportion of people and that our focus really should be on prevention. And for the small number of people that develop delirium, even after the best preventive elements, if it's detected early and the precipitants are identified, even in people who have advanced illness, over half can still be reversed. But even after reversal, people may not regain the same physical function or cognitive function, which is why I say that prevention is still really the critical thing here.
Does the incidence of delirium increase the closer a patient gets to the end of their life?
As illness progresses, some studies have said about 80%, say, eight out of 10 people at the end of life will have cognitive change or delirium.
80%. It's really something that's not talked about. How do families react to patients with delirium?
So we know that patients and families value cognition, and one of the things that are really important to them is that if I can maintain my cognition and my ability to communicate to my loved ones at the end of life, that's some people even rate that higher than good pain control. So that's how important it is to patients and families. I think as a healthcare system, we often assume that losing brain function is part of the normal process of advanced illness and dying. For many people, it isn't. And so I think it's a bit of an attitude change in terms of how we approach those symptoms of cognitive change and ensuring that if it is a reversible problem, that we are undertaking to do that.